This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome. We're on Twitter at KUOW, so jump aboard. Edgar Martinez got denied again yesterday. He was a great hitter for the Mariners. Seemed like a nice, humble, hardworking guy. And for the ninth time in a row, he gets kept out of the Hall of Fame. Seattle is howling. How do you deny a seven-time All-Star, two-time batting champion? This is anti-Northwest bias. Is a New Yorker going to admit, even if that New Yorker is even self-aware, is he going to admit that the deck is stacked against you if all you do is quietly excel out here in the hinterlands? Here is that New Yorker chuckling, the host of the Daily News podcast, The Gist. Welcome back, Mike Pesca.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always funny when you hear that such a phrase as anti-Northwest bias exists. Yes, it's the we're more anti-South-Southeast bias.
Okay, Edgar Martinez denial, travesty, mockery, or sham?
A travesty wrapped in a mockery, surrounded by a sham wrapped in bacon. So here's the deal. Edgar Martinez deserves to get in the Hall of Fame. I wouldn't say, I actually wouldn't, to be serious, apply those words to him being out. He is better than many, many Hall of Famers. I would not say he's better than most Hall of Famers, but of course, the criterion for getting on the Hall is not that you're better than most, then we couldn't have a Hall. It would be logically impossible. It's that you are, that is the company you belong with. And by all the advanced metrics, by how excellent a hitter he was, he certainly deserves to be in. However, there are some guys who aren't in the Hall, who you could argue, I think, well, like Lou Whitaker, who are a little bit better than Edgar Martinez. What I would say, and the saving grace for all of this argument, is even though we feel bad for Edgar and he had to sit through it, and he even said he was watching the online tracker where people survey the writers to see if they're going to get in, he got over 70% of the vote. In the history of Baseball Hall of Fame voting, there's only been one player who ever got over 50% of the vote who didn't earn his way in, and that player was Duke Snider, and through other means, he did actually get in. They changed the rules a little. Okay. So what I'm saying is, he's got another year of eligibility. Mm-hmm. He's above 70%. This argues for he's a guy who's going to get in next year.
Let's pause and kind of break down the case against Edgar Martinez, which is, I assume, that for most of his career, he only played half the game. He was a designated hitter, which means he didn't play in the field. He just would hit and limp around the bases. That gets you in the Hall of Fame?
I suppose some benighted scribes might adhere to that way of thinking. The logical way to think about it is, how do you help your team, and taking into account that defense is a part of the game, but it's not half the game. I mean, the right fielder might stay in right field and get two balls hit to him all game. That's not half the game. And I would also look at, take Reggie Jackson. Now, it's a better hitter than Edgar Martinez. He's a great, great hitter. So he plays right field, and especially in the last like 6-7 years of his career when he was with the California Angels. Perhaps you remember him from The Naked Gun trying to kill the Queen. He's costing his team's runs out in right field. So just the very fact that he's playing right field, if he's playing right field badly or any position badly, that shouldn't help a player's chances. Edgar Martinez did play third base, some first base for a while. He was actually, according to the stats, a slightly above average third baseman. But then the team said, we'd be better off slotting other better players at third and using him in a position that exists on a major league roster. And if it does, how could you keep that position from the Hall? And oh, by the way, Frank Thomas, a full-time DH, is already in the Hall, so there's precedent for that.
Let me ask you about something that is being said a lot in Seattle right now. Nice guy. Does that matter in Hall of Fame voting? Does it? Should it?
It does. Maybe it should. It does because it's human beings who are voting for the Hall. Very flawed human beings, because they're members of the Baseball Writers Association of America.
Ouch.
So these scribes have to deal with the player, and if they think that he's a nice person, that will, of course, we're all human and we're all influenced by that. And if a person is an ornery old cuss, he might get dinged by the Baseball Writers, either consciously or subconsciously. And I do have to say that nice guy metric is sometimes wrong. Like, Kirby Puckett was voted into the Hall on somewhat questionable credentials because he was such a nice guy. And then all this stuff came out about Kirby Puckett and what we would now call, you know, sexual harassment or sexual assault, that paints him in a much different light.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying that would seem, among the flaws of how they elect people in the Hall of Fame, that nice guy part of it does seem to be more of a flaw than a virtue.
Yeah, agreed. He seemed like a nice guy. The team wrote him into a TV ad and gave him an arguably funny line and became a catchphrase, and he was a fantastic player, and he was really loved here. What about this? Because he was so slow, his hits had to be way better than comparable hitters. For Edgar Martinez to get a double, he had to hit a triple that rattled around in the corner, the poor man.
Well, okay. I mean, that shouldn't get you in the Hall.
Okay.
That's like, he's a track star with a limp. We're not going to shave a half second off his time.
Fair enough. I brought up the Northwest bias. I don't know. Yeah. You're from New York. Yeah. But this is a thing we complain, whether it's the sportscasters are focusing on Michael Jordan and the Bulls and not the Sonics or whatever it is. You know, does that exist?
Given this day and age, don't you like going under the radar a little bit? I mean, do you really want to be in one of those towns where players won't come because everyone will descend upon you and hate you? What I would really say, though, in all honesty, here and there might be a bias when it comes to voting for the UW Huskies, that very subjective voting for who's ranked first or second.
There you go.
That comes into account. I acknowledge that. But we're talking about the baseball writers who know the game, and Edgar Martinez had such a reputation that the cliched thing to say about him was professional hitter, and that all the other players would come to the steps of the dugout if they weren't already in the field, and they would just watch and observe Edgar Martinez do his thing, a craftsman. All the writers know that. They know that Edgar Martinez is pretty synonymous with professional hitting.
Last question. I see he keeps getting more votes every year. What happens next year?
I think he gets in because that has been the trend. Trevor Hoffman, the reliever, just missed it by a couple of votes. And the writers also know that you have only certain years of eligibility left, and Martinez's will be up. So I can't
what
say.
What kind of game are you playing with us, baseball writers? You're just going to toy with us until his final year?
I think we can't say shoo-in, right? We can't give the 99% 538 Nate Silver seal of approval. But if we could, I'd say Edgar Martinez will be in the Hall of Fame.
Mike Peskett breaks down current events, not just sports, not even mostly sports, on his terrific daily news podcast, The Gist. Mike, pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Edgar Martinez denied this week, but one more chance for a Hall of Fame induction. We'll see about next year. Isn't that the Mariner slogan? Maybe next year. It's KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. I have a question for you. What kind of medical care would you want if you had Alzheimer's or dementia? That's an uncomfortable question, but you might be better off answering it now before dementia comes on. And here's a new tool to help you do that from an internist at UW Medicine. It tells your doctor and loved ones what kind of treatment you would want at each stage of dementia. Dr. Barat Gaster, welcome to KUOW.
Hi, great to be here.
Also with us is someone who has filled out this directive. Carl Pergam is 76 years old, lives in Redmond. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. I want to first ask Dr. Gaster, I'm looking at your form right here, and it outlines the different stages of dementia. If I had mild dementia, then if I had moderate dementia. Why do you do that?
Dementia is a really unique and difficult problem in that it's a very, very slow, gradual decline in cognitive function. And so people's quality of life will very gradually decline, and their ability to make decisions about their own medical care will also gradually decline. And so you can't say, if I have dementia, I want this. It really is, what would I want at various stages of dementia? Because dementia is a changing condition as people go through it.
And those are imperfect definitions, of course, at any spot in time. My mother has dementia. I'm learning this. These things ebb and flow. So there's that. But what is a typical example of what a patient would choose? Give us an idea. What are these choices?
Yeah, I mean, so when somebody has mild dementia, their quality of life can still actually be quite good.
Yes.
They can really still enjoy a lot of things, interact with their loved ones. And so they may, at that early stage, say, I do want most care to keep me alive longer. But then as somebody's cognitive function worsens and they lose the ability to interact with the world around them and recognize their loved ones, many people would say, you know, gee, that is not a quality of life that has a lot of meaning to me. And people see the difficulty that people with moderate and severe dementia can experience in terms of fear and anxiety and discomfort. And many people would say, gee, as my cognitive function gets worse, as I get to those stages of dementia, that is not necessarily a life that I want prolonged with medical care. And okay. Instead, I would choose care that is really focused on comfort, keeping me comfortable. And so it's a very caring kind of care, but it is not care with the goal of keeping me alive longer.
Okay, and of course, I have questions about that. I want to pause there, doctor, and ask Carl. Carl, why did you decide to fill out this advanced dementia directive?
My wife and I already have living wills, and we've had them for many years. I'm a retired physician. My wife is a retired physician. I have a son who's a physician at Fred Hutchinson and SCCA who deals with patients with terminal events and cancer, as obviously. But I thought this was a little bit to the side of what a typical advanced directive is. It was something where I could really look at it and say, this is what I want. I want to make the decision. I don't want to force my family, my kids, I have two children, to make that decision and be uncomfortable about the decision. I've seen people in similar situations as dementia progresses. I've been involved in that in a peripheral way. I'm a radiologist, so I don't have due primary care. But I thought this added something to my advanced directive, my living will.
Do you mind sharing with us a decision you made, or would you rather keep that private?
No, that's fine.
Okay, what did you direct?
As an example, supposing I don't know what's going on in the world. I'm being helped around by my wife or a caregiver, and I get pneumonia, and somebody gets me to the emergency room. And here I am in the hospital now. I've been admitted. I have pneumonia. They're going to start me on IV antibiotics. Maybe I need to be intubated, have a tube put in my... I don't want that. If my level of dementia is such that my quality of life is no longer there, I'm just there. So that's an example. Another example would be, yes, I have a low-grade fever on a chest X-ray. I have a small area of pneumonia. I don't need to be in the hospital. I can be treated as an outpatient. So it makes it much easier for my family to say, how far should we go?
Carl, what happens if you make that decision as you've made, and then the time comes later and you're in some stage of dementia and you say something very different? Now, I do want this life support, or I want to be in the hospital instead of at home, but you've got this signed document. Then what happens?
I would hope in that situation that those people taking care of me, whether it be my wife at that time, my children, would understand where I was, what I understood, how much I knew at the time when I made the initial decision, and say, no, Dad, I think it's a good idea for you to just stop right there. I don't know that you need to be intubated. I don't know that you need to have IV antibiotics. Let's go home and let's enjoy life.
Well, that's a nice way to put it, but you won't have that choice, right? Doctor? This will be, you're going to go by the document, not what the patient in front of you is saying.
So, no.
Oh, okay. But yeah, please explain.
You have hit upon the absolutely most important part about this document, which is that this is not a legally binding document.
Aha. Uh-huh.
This is a communication tool. This is a tool that people can use to express what their wishes are now that can be used in the future by somebody's future surrogate decision maker for healthcare. So if somebody loses the ability to understand the meaning of a medical decision they have to make in the future, that decision will fall to a shared decision, ultimately the durable power of attorney for healthcare. And that person is often really stuck in a very uncomfortable position of trying to guess what the person would want and how much they understand about the decision that is before them. And at all times, it really is the decision of that surrogate decision maker. And this is a tool that can help to inform that decision, as could a conversation with the person at that moment. You know, so this document does not overrule what somebody's wishes are at the time. But what really commonly happens is the person, the patient, is not able to fully understand what the pros and cons of a decision are. You know, whatever their wishes are really should be taken into account at that time as much as absolutely possible. But often it is trying to imagine if this person could fully understand what was going on, what would they want? And this form is an opportunity, as a tool to see what they had thought in the past, which should be somewhat of a guide for what they might want now.
It's a guide, a communication tool. Okay, that's hugely important. So thanks for making that clear. Carl, what is your experience with someone who has dementia and is trying to make decisions that you don't know whether that they're for that person's ultimate benefit?
I can honestly say I am a radiologist, so I don't deal with primary patients.
Mm-hmm.
So I have never dealt with a patient who had dementia and subsequently was asked to make a decision. I do know that the problem that occurs, whether it's dementia or any other life-saving or life-benefiting situation, that the problem comes often with the other members of the family. In fact, I even consulted my attorney with the form, and I sent it to her, and she said, these forms, whether it be a living will or this advanced directive for dementia, are in a sense only as good as the paper they're written on, because at that time things can change and the patient can get involved, as you say, or the family can get involved and say, no, I'm the third brother and the other ones have taken care of the family and now I'm the guy that was on the out and I don't want something to happen. I don't want this to be done to Dad or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I give this form out to people, the thing that I tell them is the most important thing is that they talk to their loved ones, the people who would be the decision makers for them, about what their values and wishes are as outlined in the form. And so this form is a way of structuring that conversation, anchoring that conversation, facilitating that conversation that can be drawn upon later when that person is in what is often a really excruciating spot of having to make decisions on their family member's behalf.
How much weight do we know it's wise to put on a decision that someone made before dementia set in compared with the person who is living a situation that earlier version of themselves? I can't imagine what dementia might or will be like for me and what I'm going to want and my priorities might change. Is it fair to make decisions for future me based on what I think of as important or dignified or all kinds of things that are really hard for me to define?
Sure. I mean, to a large extent, people's wishes, as best as you can tell them in the moment, should be the most important thing. And but, you know, the very common situation is, you know, so, I mean, which is why the mild dementia aspect is a little bit—it's a little bit more of a stretch, because generally speaking, for most medical decisions, people still are competent to make them when they have mild dementia, and so by putting mild dementia on this form, it really is a way of just facilitating the conversation and the understanding that this is a gradual decline that people have in their cognitive function and their quality of life. But that once people reach the point of moderate and severe dementia, they really will not fully be able to understand the consequences of of a complex medical decision like, should I be hooked up to a ventilator or not? Mm-hmm. You know, that the potential harms that some medical interventions like that can cause when people have moderate and severe dementia are considerable. And people, without a form like this, when people are in limbo and feel afraid to make a decision, not being sure what the person would have wanted, and they truly aren't able to make that decision for themselves, can really lead to people getting a lot more invasive and problematic care that causes suffering, that if you were able to bring back the person from 5 or 10 years ago to look down on themselves, they would say, good gosh, I do not want this being done to me. And a form like this is a way to facilitate that communication from your past self to your current self, who isn't truly able to understand.
Carl, it's hard enough to fill out a living will, an advance directive. Most of us don't want to think about death, even though that is guaranteed, much less something that, boy, I don't know if I'm going to go through that. I don't really want to think about dementia, although I am now, as I said, my mother's in this situation. But what has it been like for you to contemplate and plan for the case of your own dementia? What's that like?
I find it not difficult at all. I think that I have known a number of people who have not looked at this in the future. It's just happened. If you plan on it, you can discuss it with your family. They know what you want. They know what's best for you, what you think is best for you. I found it very easy. It was something, in fact, when Dr. Gaster gave it to me, I thought, wow, this is a great idea, because this goes beyond my living will. This is another part of me that my family now knows what I want to happen to me. And it's kind of fascinating to think that I brought this home, and my wife's also a physician or a pediatrician, and I showed it to her, and she said she thought it was a pretty good idea as well. And then I asked her to fill it out, and I said, what do you think? And she says, oh, good, I'll fill it out. It's interesting. We've been married almost 52 years. The exact responses were the same. Her response and my response were the same. And so I am really comfortable and happy with the fact that my children now know, my wife now knows, everybody knows where I'm going, what direction I'm going in. And I look at it as a positive thing in my future. I don't have to worry about this for my family and so forth. So for me, it was easy.
Carl Pergam, who lives in Redmond, found it easy to do something that maybe you have a hard time or would rather not think about. But it just sounds like it's been a comfort and a nice conversation.
Absolutely.
Between you and your wife. Carl, thanks for telling us about your personal experience with this.
It's a pleasure.
And Dr. Barak Gaster, University of Washington Medicine, has developed this Advanced Dementia Directive. And if you want to find out more about it, the website is dementia, is that a hyphen?
Yep.
Directive.org?
Correct. Yep. www.dementia-directive.org. Anybody can download a copy of the form for free. Feel free to use it and share it and have conversations about it.
Well, of course, we're tweeting that out right now, so follow us at KUOW. Doctor, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back.
I have an 8-year-old daughter that cries all the time, wondering why she didn't get to meet my mother, why somebody took her life. And I have no answers for her at all. He is a monster. And he sits there while our tax dollars go to him living. That's not fair to us.
Is Washington State going to put an end to capital punishment? You were just listening to Jesse Trapp arguing against a capital punishment repeal this week at a public hearing in Olympia. Her mother's killer sits on death row. The death penalty's been on hold here since 2014 when Governor Inslee declared a moratorium on executions. We're going to get an update on what lawmakers are up to right now from our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins, in just a moment. First, KUOW reporter Patricia Murphy was a media witness at the execution of the last person to be put to death by Washington State. Cal Coburn Brown was executed by lethal injection in 2010 for the rape and murder of a 21-year-old Burien woman. Patricia, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Bill.
So our state lawmakers are debating this, hearing the arguments, pro and con, and casting votes. You saw this system in action, which is something few people ever see. What are you expecting?
Well, I had been in the chamber prior to this execution for a tour because of a series I was working on. But honestly, that night, I had no idea what I would see. What I did see was no surprise. It was an unremarkable experience, which is exactly what the Department of Corrections goes for in these kinds of situations. It was rehearsed. It was professional. It was streamlined. It took us longer to get to the chamber than it took for him to die once they started that lethal drip.
Okay. Professional and streamlined. What takes place in the state penitentiary? What happens when a person is put to death?
So what happens in terms of the actual mechanics of an execution actually starts about 30 days prior. And the way they do this is they divide the responsibility of this job up among many people. And that is a kindness to the executioner. I did not kill the prisoner. I strapped his right arm down. So it's divided, and that's a kindness. So those
different people have different small jobs.
Different jobs. So that night, the media witnesses are taken in. We're searched. We're issued a pencil and a pad. We're taken to the execution chamber, which is a room that has a large viewing window. It is on the bottom viewing window is the lethal injection chamber. The upper window is actually the gallows because you can be hanged still in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So we walk into the chamber. Brown's victim's family members were on the left-hand side. Media witnesses were on the right-hand side. A curtain was pulled up. Cal Brown was strapped to a gurney. This was an unsettling moment for me. He was staring at me. He's given his last words. Stephen Sinclair, the Department of Corrections superintendent at the time, gives a signal to someone behind a panel that you can't see, and that drip is started. And it was a very, very unremarkable experience from that perspective, from a physical, viewing perspective.
So media witnesses and victims, family members, not family members of Cal Brown?
It was my understanding they are allowed to attend.
Okay.
I'm not sure how the DOC would handle that, but they are allowed to attend. Cal Brown was in touch with his family members. No one came to the execution, and his attorney had to claim his body at the end of the night.
What about family members who you have interviewed? How do they feel about executions?
I've talked to a lot of family members who have had victim family members who've had the killer executed. One was very relieved. This was a sense of renewal for her that she could now move on with her life. One simply said it really didn't impact his life very much at all. He just didn't think about that guy very much. And in Cal Brown's case, Holly Wass's family, the victim's family members, were absolutely furious that the media was there. They considered this a private moment for the family, but the reality is that it is state law that the media witnesses an execution. It's a transparency thing. But they were furious, and you could sense that as soon as we walked in the room. They clearly did not want us there.
That's KUOW reporter Patricia Murphy, who was a witness to the last execution that Washington State has done. This was Cal Brown in 2010, and again, the legislature is considering abolishing the death penalty. Right now, there is a moratorium placed on the death penalty. Let's bring in Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins. Hi, Austin.
Hello.
So there was a push to ban the death penalty last year. What's different this time?
Yeah, this is, you know, kind of a perennial bill. Somebody usually every year introduces a death penalty repeal bill, and it usually goes nowhere. But supporters of repeal have had the sense that momentum is building for this, and that if they are patient, that the public will come around to believing that repeal is the right way to go, and that they'll eventually be able to get this through the legislature. And they've been watching what's happened around the country in other states, where in some cases it's been a bipartisan effort. So what's significant is that today the Senate Law and Justice Committee has now moved the death penalty repeal bill out of committee. That is usually not, you know, a stop the presses moment, but in this case, it is a significant step forward in this effort. A long way to final passage and a governor's signature, but a not insignificant step. The question now is going to be, does this get a vote on the floor of the state Senate? And that remains to be seen.
Why is this push happening since we have the same governor in office who declared this moratorium years ago? We're at this status quo position where no one's being executed. So why is this happening?
The governor, when he announced his moratorium, said that he hoped this would spark a conversation in Washington about death penalty repeal. He wasn't necessarily going to lead that conversation, but what happened this week that is certainly noteworthy is that King County prosecutor Dan Satterberg published an op-ed in the Seattle Times over the weekend and then came down and testified on Monday in favor of repeal, saying that he has come to the conclusion that the criminal justice system in the state of Washington would be, in his words, stronger without the death penalty. Now, not all prosecutors agree with him. In fact, there were a couple of prosecutors who showed up to say that they believe the death penalty should remain in place, or at the least, it should be a vote of the people. But to see the prosecutor, a Republican prosecutor in the state's most populous county, coming out against the death penalty is certainly a sign of changing times.
Do you know about a trend nationwide that Washington State might or might not be a part of when it comes to abolishing the death penalty?
It certainly is happening more and more across the country. We're seeing, if you look at the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and you look at that map, there are several states in recent years that have either repealed legislatively the death penalty, or the courts in their states have thrown out the death penalty. The other thing here's another kind of interesting statistic, again, from the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. 40 states have not carried out an execution between 2013 and 2017. And this, I think, gets to maybe answering the question you just asked, Bill, which is why are we having this conversation now? Why, if there's a moratorium, should there be a conversation about this? You know, why do advocates believe there should be? The key argument that Dan Satterberg is making is that the death penalty isn't working. Yes, we have people on death row, but the appeals process goes on for decades and decades, and the cost is so expensive that most counties won't even pursue a death penalty conviction because of the cost. And so his argument is it's not working. The flip side of that is Jamie Bindel was a correctional officer at the Monroe Correctional Facility who was murdered by Byron Scherf, who was serving life in prison without the possibility of parole, a three-strikes offender, and he strangled her to death. What's the penalty for Byron Scherf if there's no death penalty? The Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway, confessed to and led investigators to numerous victims because they used the death penalty as something of leverage. So there are cases, and even Dan Satterberg will admit, there are some cases where he sees value, but he thinks ultimately It's past its time in Washington State. Clearly, there are many others who feel like this should remain on the books.
Finally, Austin, whether it's from lawmakers or an initiative, what are the odds that this capital punishment repeal is going to happen, say, in the next year?
I think that in a short 60-day election year session that the default position would be it's not going to happen in 2018. I also think that if it gets a vote on the floor of the state Senate, that would be a very, very significant step in this effort. The Lieutenant Governor, Cyrus Habib, who is the chair of the Rules Committee, that's sort of the gatekeeper to what goes out under the floor, tweeted at me today that he's going to be encouraging a floor vote on it. We know that the prime sponsor, Jamie Peterson, State Senator Jamie Peterson, would like to see a floor vote. But I would be very surprised if the repeal happens in 2018.
That's KUOW's Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Austin, thanks.
You're welcome.
And finally, back to you, Patricia Murphy, KUOW reporter. As we said, you witnessed that execution of Cal Brown 7 years ago now, and you described it being clinical and routine. If you don't mind, I'm curious how it has stayed with you, whether that witnessing that has affected you.
You know, it's certainly a macabre club to be part of. At the time, I considered it an important historic event that I felt privileged to cover, right? But honestly, it was not an easy experience, and it took a while. One of the people I interviewed before I did that was a medical ethicist who sent me a text that night and said, "Hey, things are going to come up about this. Get in touch when they do." And I was like, I'm in work mode. You know, I'm in work
mode. That's my job.
Yeah. About a week and a half later, things really started to come up. It is not an easy situation. Don't let the professionalism and sanitary nature of it detract from the difficulty of witnessing that in the moment.
Right. Whatever anyone's stance on it is, it's a serious, serious thing that Patricia Murphy has seen in person. As the legislature contemplates now possibly abolishing the death penalty in Washington State. Patricia Murphy, thanks for this.
Thanks, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Back in a moment.
It's 12:46. This is KUOW Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Pizza Klatch, dedicated to providing life-saving services for LGBTQ youth. Presenting a Slice of the Good Life Gala, Concert, and Auction featuring singer, poet, and activist Mary Lambert. Saturday, February 3rd in Olympia at the Washington Center. Tickets at washingtoncenter.org.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Business at SeaTac Airport has been booming. And so have its carbon emissions. If you are a frequent flyer, your air travel probably changes the climate more than anything else you do. As part of our series, The Burning Question, KUOW's John Ryan takes a look at SeaTac's efforts to do less harm to the sky.
A Horizon Airlines plane is parked at the gate. Next to it is a long yellow rack with a dozen black cables sticking out. It's a charging station for those little cars that haul luggage and push planes around. Here, they don't need to burn diesel anymore.
What we're looking at right now is one of our key initiatives to try to reduce emissions at the airport.
So Elizabeth Levitt runs environmental programs at SeaTac.
We've got this installed now at the north half of the airport, working on the south half, and we're excited.
That's because when the whole airport has these charging stations a couple years from now, they'll be
saving about 1 million gallons of gasoline every year that would have powered this equipment and cutting our carbon emissions.
1 million gallons of fuel, that sounds like a lot, but here's the thing. Each year, airplanes drink up around 600 million gallons of jet fuel at SeaTac, and the number of planes flying out of SeaTac is taking off.
Well, the airport has actually been the fastest growing airport in North America for the last 3 years, and we've seen incredible growth.
Over the next 20 years, the Port of Seattle is planning to double international flights at SeaTac and triple air cargo. That growth makes reducing emissions a steep climb, especially when possible solutions like biofuels or electric airplanes are a long way from being commercially viable.
So I just wonder, doesn't reducing demand have to be part of the picture?
We have to grow because of what the public demands of us, and that's the role that the Washington State Legislature has really given the Port of Seattle. That's our job.
Whether it's biofuels or more efficient planes, aviation watchdog Daniel Rutherford says efforts to make flying less harmful are at a disadvantage.
We do have this current headwind in that jet fuel is very inexpensive right now.
Rutherford is with the International Council for Clean Transportation.
And as long as fuel continues to be this cheap, we wouldn't expect the manufacturers to be very ambitious on fuel efficiency.
The airline fleet is getting more efficient each year, but air travel is growing 3 times faster. On climate, aviation is still moving backwards. And as long as fuel remains cheap, the demand to fly will probably stay high, even among people who know how harmful it is. I spoke with a couple of passengers on their way to the airport. Their wheelie luggage gave them away. They both happened to do environmental work.
I went to school for environmental studies, so of course transportation was a big factor in greenhouse gas emissions.
Evan Bew was on his way to Oakland.
Since you're well educated on this, does the impact of flying affect, like, how much do you fly?
If I'm being honest, no.
Sarah Laycock was on her way to visit family in Florida.
Definitely the impact of my travel has crossed my mind, but I'm not an expert in what I can do specifically as an individual.
I asked her if she ever avoided flying because of the impact.
To be honest, I haven't. It's not really an option for me not to visit my family.
Laycock said she was glad to learn that her airline, Alaska, is one of the more fuel-efficient ones. Even with rapid growth, SeaTac officials say they can slash emissions by improving efficiency and using things like biofuel. But there's a catch. Jet fuel is the airport's dominant source of pollution, but the airport only cares about jet fuel if it's burned on the ground or during takeoffs and landings. If a plane's above 3,000 feet in the sky, SeaTac and other airports say the emissions are airlines' responsibility. The U.S. doesn't regulate carbon pollution from planes. That's unlike cars or trucks. It is technologically harder to fly without burning fossil fuels than it is to drive. Here's aviation booster and climate hawk Jay Inslee. You may know him as the governor of Washington.
We know we can electrify cars quite well. They're coming on the roads like gangbusters. It's more difficult to electrify a plane. So we do what is easiest, cheapest, and most effective first, which is electrify the ground transportation system.
The governor's proposed carbon tax would not apply to jet fuel. That's in contrast to gasoline and diesel. They'd be taxed about 18 cents a gallon. Reporting from SeaTac Airport, I'm John Ryan, KUOW News.
Coming up later this afternoon on KUOW, we're going to go to Washington, D.C., where Republicans are sounding the alarm over text messages that have gone missing at the FBI. We're going to take a look at the animosity between the FBI and the GOP and what it means for the investigation by the special counsel, Robert Mueller. That's one of the stories you'll hear later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. KUOW Seattle, I hope you're joining us on Twitter, at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle is waiting for its NHL hockey team to come play in Key Arena. The league is going to make an announcement soon about expanding into Seattle. But what to call the new team? Well, we've got some hints about that. The company that's trying to bring Seattle this NHL team has registered some possible internet domain names. I can't be objective about the following list of names. I'm too close to it. So we're going to go to the city that would instantly be Seattle's hockey rival, Vancouver, home of the Canucks. We're going to talk about this list of possible team names. We've got Cougars, Eagles, Emeralds, Evergreens, Firebirds, Kraken. We're going to get back to Kraken. Rainiers, Renegades, Sea Lions, Seals, Sockeyes, Totems, and Whales. We're talking with Harrison Mooney, a Van Live reporter for the Vancouver Sun. Harrison, what's your overall reaction to these possible future rival names?
Well, I don't think it's a very good list. Some of these team names have a little potential, I guess. The Totems, I like for a couple of reasons. The Emeralds, the Evergreens, they're okay. But, I mean, most of these names, I mean, the Kraken, people are going to have a hard time even pronouncing that properly. You're going to get some people saying Kraken. Mm-hmm. I think the Rainiers is silly.
Why is the Rainiers silly?
You know, I mean, it's the name of the mountain right now, but it may not be the name of the mountain later. You know, I know Mount McKinley became Denali not that long ago. Mm-hmm. And I just think it would be very unfortunate for Seattle's hockey team to be named after a mountain and then see the mountain change its name.
Plus, as you pointed out in your piece, who named Rainier?
Yes, that's the other thing. Rainier was named by Captain George Vancouver, and that's Vancouver's namesake. And I think when you're talking about your closest geographic rival, you definitely don't want to give them those bragging rights that their guy named your team.
Yeah, and the Vancouver Canucks are a problem in a couple of ways because it's would be Seattle's rival. Plus, your logo has got a whale in it, an orca whale, right?
Yeah, so I just feel like you probably shouldn't name this team after anything that orcas eat.
Yeah.
You know, so that's going to rule out the sea lions. That's going to rule out the seals, the sockeyes. I mean, frankly, it could even rule out the birds, but that doesn't happen too often.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you were saying we go for something that threatens the orcas.
Yeah, you know, Seattle SeaWorld, I think, was my big suggestion. Or, you know, the harpooners, the whalers is available, but definitely not the sea lions or the seals. That's a nightmare.
Yeah, Seattle Whalers is not going to go over here. I can guarantee that.
Yeah, the Seattle Great Pacific Garbage Patch, mm-hmm. I think, is, I mean, that's definitely threatening most wildlife.
Right. And then you've got some of your own ideas, the Seattle Amazons.
I actually do like that one. I mean, I know that, you know, naming a men's hockey team after a group of women warriors might be something that makes some men pretty uncomfortable. But, you know, isn't that kind of the flavor of the moment, making men uncomfortable? I feel like maybe Seattle can get on board with that. I mean, Amazons, you've already got the connection to the Amazon headquarters there. I think they should do it. They probably won't. And seeing as they didn't register that as one of their 13 domain names, they definitely won't. But that's my best suggestion. You know, plus Wonder Woman's an Amazon. Wonder Woman's the best.
There's a troublemaker in you, Harrison, clearly, when you're suggesting the Seattle Grizzlies.
Well, yeah, you know, the main thing for me when it comes to, you know, this Vancouver-Seattle rivalry that will happen is, you know, I think we should stoke it a little bit. And, I mean, you can actually go way back. You know, the Seattle-Vancouver hockey rivalry is a real thing already. You know, the Seattle Totems. The Totems were almost in the NHL. They were awarded an NHL franchise in the mid-70s, but the Vancouver Canucks didn't want them to have it, and the Canucks owned minority shares in the team. So they just withheld selling these shares back for a while and helped to scuttle the deal. In 1975, Seattle's ownership group sued Vancouver and the NHL for basically colluding to keep them from getting the franchise that they'd already been awarded. So, I mean, that's the Totems who wound up tanking. I think if you name this team the Totems and they come back to the NHL, you're picking up a rivalry that started with some very shady business practices.
And so when you suggest the Grizzlies, which is the NBA basketball team that Vancouver lost,
you know, I mean, that's...
you're stoking the fight.
Absolutely. You know, just twist the knife a little bit by reminding them, hey, you lost the Grizzlies. Well, now we're the Grizzlies. And then if the Seattle Grizzlies win the Stanley Cup before Vancouver has ever won a Stanley Cup, I mean, that would crush us. I'm not going to lie. That would destroy us.
And yet here you are twisting the harpoon.
Well, I mean, it would be fun, I think, to be crushed.
You are a Canucks fan advising Seattle on its team. I just want to make clear you could be some kind of secret agent.
Oh, yeah, I'm a big-time Canucks fan, but the one thing that all Canucks fans will tell you is we're full of self-loathing, you know, and we're always just looking for drama because we're not going to see any championships anytime soon. So we just like to stir the pot.
You must have spent some time in Seattle, Harrison.
Yeah, I have.
What do you think? Because we're having this inner debate. Are we a hockey town or are we not?
I mean, I absolutely think that you guys are a hockey town. First of all, overwhelmingly white population. Mm-hmm. That's a big thing for hockey teams. That's why it didn't work in Atlanta as much as I wanted it to. But, you know, on top of that, Seattle has had a ton of professional ice hockey franchises. It's never stuck.
Yeah, nothing sticks here. It falls and it melts.
I absolutely think that Seattle is a viable NHL market. And they have technology that makes the ice now. You'll be fine.
Harrison Mooney, the Van Live reporter for the Vancouver Sun. Good to talk with you about our impending hatred. I don't hate you now, but eventually, you know, we're going to have to loathe each other.
Oh, I'm sure you will eventually. Thanks for having me.
And here's an update on the hockey names. There's been another entry, a new domain name that somebody registered late last week after we learned about this list. We don't know who they are. We don't know whether they're connected to the team's would-be owners, but they have registered SeattleSasquatch.com. Seattle Sasquatch, good mascot potential here. I'm going to be registering Seattle Yeti right after the show, and you might want to get on that too. That is all for today. That's our program, a show made for you by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano. We got help today from Casey Martin and Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow is Friday, so tomorrow's the Week in Review. Spend the hour with us, and we'll catch you up on everything you missed this week and what it all means. That's it for today. Thanks for listening.